Phone the comment line 1850 715 900.
And with me now, RTE's Europe editor for news and current affairs, Tony Connolly, of course based in Brussels, but previously reporting on conflicts in Rwanda, Angola, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Georgia and Gaza. Tony is here to discuss Don't Mention the Wars, A Journey Through European Stereotypes. It's published or republished by New Ireland and is for sale in an updated edition at €19.99. Tony, before we talk about stereotypes, again, the situation in Ukraine and also a lot of tension and I suppose haggling to be done at European level. What is to be done about this? What is to be done about Putin? Are people prepared to pay the economic price? David Cameron, for instance, in the Commons yesterday seemed to be pushing very hard for serious measures to deal with what he called Putin's bluster and obfuscation.
It's been difficult for Europe to get a single concerted and coherent line on this, and it's partly for historical reasons, partly for economic reasons. As we heard in that previous interview, countries like the Netherlands, countries like Italy have very strong trading links with Russia. Germany, probably more than many other countries, has very deep economic links, and countries also rely very heavily on Russia for their energy needs. Also, countries that have a historical connection with Russia, like Greece, like Cyprus. So it's been very difficult to get all of the EU countries to come up with a single robust response. So we've had, I suppose, graduated responses over the past 6 months. We've had sanctions targeted at individuals, both in connection with Crimea and targeting people who are associated with Mr. Putin's inner circle. The big question was, when would we move to what's called stage three sanctions, which would be the full, broad Iran-style sanctions against the Russian economy, economic and trade sanctions. And those countries that I've mentioned have been very reluctant to move to that stage. But I think this is a game changer. I was speaking to officials on Friday in Brussels who were, even though a lot of the delegations in Brussels where these things are worked out and ironed out before foreign ministers meet, even on Thursday night and Friday in the immediate aftermath of this disaster, they were kind of sticking to fairly entrenched positions. But I think over the weekend, we saw a dramatic shift and the whole spectrum of opinion was moving with all 28 countries moving to a much more tough line against Russia. And I think this is a game changer. There will be probably much tougher sanctions announced tomorrow, or today rather.
Is there a sense, Tony, that if a line isn't drawn now, that in 6 months' time or in 2 years' time, it won't be his incursions into Ukraine or Crimea we'll be concerned about, or we'll be talking about, for instance, the Baltics coming back, those states which are now full members of the European Union coming under renewed pressure? Is that the fear?
Well, that was certainly the fear among the Baltic states, and they have been the most vociferous in trying to push for a stronger EU line. Also, Poland and Sweden have been very strong. But I think there was also a sense over the past couple of months that countries were prepared to accept a new status quo. They were prepared to accept that Crimea was lost. It would never go back to Ukraine. They were prepared to accept a kind of an understanding that Russia would keep some kind of influence in Ukraine, that Ukraine would forswear any decision to join NATO or to join the EU, and that people could live with it. But I think now that as reflected in the previous interview, this is different, because this is really European citizens who've been blown out of the sky. This will bring enormous political pressure at home for a much more existential response by Europe, saying that this is far enough and Russia must be stopped.
Probably a timely moment for a publication like your own, looking at European stereotypes. Don't Mention the Wars, is the main title. You look at, I think, about a dozen states. You've added Greece this time.
That's right. The book first came out in 2009. It looked at 10 countries, and basically the premise of the book was to look at the set of stereotypes that we have of European countries, and to, I suppose, expose these ideas to a journalistic investigation. Why do we have these ideas? Where do they come from? Are they true? And the book came out just as the Greek debt crisis was starting. In fact, it was the same month. It was November 2009. There was an official in Eurostat in Luxembourg who got a letter from the Greek government saying our figures are slightly wrong, so we need to revise the figures. And that triggered the euro crisis. First of all, the Greek crisis, then Ireland, then Portugal. And, you know, back in 2012, the entire future of the European project looked like it was at risk. And in many ways, the European debt crisis was being fought on a platform or in an arena of stereotyping. We had lazy Greeks. We had the German fixation with austerity was somehow linked to their desire to dominate Europe, even to their Nazi past. You had depictions of Angela Merkel all over Europe as a Nazi, with a Hitler moustache, that kind of thing. And so I felt that the book could really do with a new edition. So there is a new chapter on Greece, and the whole German economic orthodoxy is examined. There's a new chapter on Germany and so on. So
and you've revisited other states as well. But do you think stereotyping in Europe, because I think you're saying the introduction, this discussion, the fun has gone out of it since the crisis. Has it changed much since, say, 2008 or thereabouts?
Well, what struck me was that stereotyping during the euro crisis was not confined to pub chatter. It wasn't even confined to tabloid headlines. The attitudes towards the Greeks and the Germans went right up to broadsheet newspapers. And it was even reflected in policy. And, at one point, at the very height of the crisis, Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, said that Greeks should take shorter holidays and retire later. When in fact, OECD statistics show that Greeks actually take shorter holidays than Germans, and they retire about the same age as Germans, 62.2 years.
And moving across from Germany to France, I think it could be true to say that you set about trying to dismiss or get away from stereotypes as being old hat. And then in France, up pop, not just the current president, François Hollande, but also Dominique Strauss-Kahn with some pretty seedy, in one instance anyway, extramarital stuff going on in their lives.
That's right. I mean, we think of the French and we think of a certain set of stereotypes. I had great fun in the book trying to work out the evolution of this idea of the French, the French lovers and their attitudes to, fidelity, infidelity. There are lots of theories going back to Amour Courtois in the 13th century, right through to the reign of the Sun King, the whole privilege of the French elite and, the whole sexual manners that went with that. It is depicted in films, it's depicted in books, and just at the moment when you think you can dismiss these attitudes as outdated and somewhat fanciful, along come people like Dominique Strauss-Kahn, François Hollande, who really shocked everybody because he, after Nicolas Sarkozy, he was meant to be the normal president. He was going to be much less ostentatious, and the next thing he's on a moped, going for midnight trysts with his young lover. And I remember covering his press conference in January, which was really to relaunch his presidency, all of the international media were there wanting to hear about this affair that had just broken. And I remember talking to lunchtime citizens walking around the Arc de Triomphe, and none of them were in any way judgmental about him. They said, "Look, this is France. This is what happens. This is what men do." So nobody thought he should resign. It was really astonishing.
What about Berlusconi, who's probably more colourful than the other pair put together?
Yeah, well, Berlusconi, in a way, he was the walking epitome of a whole set of Italian stereotypes, not just the sexual bragging, but also this kind of cheeky, roguish posture that he adopted, and also the very ostentatious wealth that he flaunted, and an awful lot of Italians aspired to that kind of persona and that idea. When these things erupt in a news sense, it often causes a huge kind of national self-examination of a country. You know, what are we like? Is this really what we're like? It also triggers a huge examination by outside observers into a national
character. To what extent, Tony, does religion enter into stereotyping? Is there a kind of a view that there's a Protestant austere North and then a chaotic Catholic South? Not just, maybe just Northern Europe as opposed to Southern Europe, leave aside the individual countries.
Well, this is a notion that was developed in the late 19th century by Max Weber, who was a German sociologist. And he argued that, Protestants were more likely to work harder, to have fewer debts, and to be, much more conscientious and entrepreneurial than Catholics were. Because Catholics had the sense of, indulgences and sins being forgiven, they were less trusted. And that whole formulation was then brought back into the debt crisis a couple of years back. And there were some commentators, by no means populist or tabloid, were saying that, just look at the countries that are in trouble: Ireland, Spain, Greece. They're all Catholic. Well, in Greece's case, they were Orthodox. The northern countries are Protestant. They're hardworking. They're God-fearing. And there was a backlash against that attitude, saying it was totally oversimplified and unfair. But in the end, this was an indication of how the Euro crisis was reawakening old demons and old rivalries and attitudes that a lot of people felt were very dangerous, and were very destructive to the whole progressive notion of European integration and harmony.
You've got a young son, Tony. I think he's about, seven at this stage, young Matteo. He lives in Rome, and some of us met him when we were over there last year covering the papal election. So bearing in mind all we've been talking about, how do you explain Northern Ireland to a young man like that? I suppose you show him around Derry for starters, yeah?
Yeah, no, I've taken him to Derry many times, and Derry is obviously a place of great sort of progress and, I suppose, consciousness raising, and has been for a while. So he goes to Derry and he just loves the Peace Bridge, and he loves the music, and he loves Donegal, and he has very, very positive associations with Ireland. And of course his granny and granddad are in Derry, and his cousins, and he has great fun there. I haven't begun to explain to him the Northern Irish situation, but on a few occasions he's told people in Rome that I'm English because I speak English, and I have to correct him very quickly.
Very good. Well, look, Tony, the book is quite a read. I'm not fully through it yet, but it's called Don't Mention the Wars: A Journey Through European Stereotypes, published by New Ireland, and it's for sale at £19.99. Tony Connolly, thank you very much. And by the way, mentioning Donegal, we're actually heading up there straight after the programme. We're going to Glenties. We're doing the show there live tomorrow. We'll have music, we'll have poetry, we'll also have interviews with two very prominent Donegal figures. Mary Coughlan, the former minister, Fianna Fáil minister, who lost her seat at the last election. She'll be joining us live at the Highland Hotel, and we'll also be talking to the man who's winning matches, Jimmy McGuinness. He's also a very busy man. We'll be talking to him too, and meeting lots of other people. That's tomorrow on Today with Sean O'Rourke, live from Glenties, 10 to 12. We may even see you there if you're in the region. But Tony, we leave it there with you. We'll be back with a discussion about slow food after the break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.